Yeah, thanks a lot, and thanks for having me. So I'm going to talk about some work some work that came out earlier in the summer, which was with Jordan Kotler, Junyu Liu, and Benny Yoshida, who's here. And I'll also mention maybe at the end some work which maybe should appear sometime at the beginning of next year. Okay. So I'm going to be talking about quantum chaos and random matrix theory and using quantum information to describe universal features of strongly interacting systems. And when I say physical systems in this talk, I'll most precisely mean systems with a finite dimensional Hilbert space in a discrete spectrum. So maybe something like spins or fermions on a lattice. Maybe they're all-to-all coupled, like SYK or something. But I think many of the things I'm going to talk about should apply to more general systems. Many of these lessons should hold true for things like quantum field theories. Or more precisely, if you take a quantum field theory that's maybe strongly coupled, put it in a box and put it on a lattice, so it has a finite dimensional Hilbert space and a discrete spectrum, I think many of the things I'm going to say also hold true. But you can argue with me about that at the end. OK. So we're all familiar with notions of classical chaos and an exponential sensitivity of phase-based trajectories to small perturbations. But chaos in quantum systems is different. But the intuition we should cling to is something like small perturbations growing to affect the system. But we know that it must be different because wave functions cannot have exponentially diverging trajectories. Overlap of two states evolved with the same Hamiltonian is constant in time. And while there is a phase-based notion of quantum mechanics, notion of exponentially diverging trajectories are murky. So it's different. Okay. And what is meant by quantum chaos seems to depend on the decade and subfield you work in. So these are very, very broad brushstrokes, but I at least hope to capture the spirit of the last 50 years of the subject. So if you had asked someone in the 1970s, they would have said quantum chaos is what you get when you quantize a classically chaotic system. And this evolved into the 80s definition of quantum chaos, which is more of a statement about universal properties of the spectrum. So something like the level spacing statistics or spectral fluctuations replicate those of a suitably chosen random matrix ensemble. And it was these ideas that led to Berry's conjecture and ETH. But the more recent revival of quantum chaos is more a statement about something that can be probed by correlation functions in thermal states. And the thing that's doing the probing is the out-of-time ordered correlation function. And we'll review these things in a second. But first, I just want to make something clear. We can take some semantic guidance from Michael Berry and just acknowledge that there's some it's not quite right that we call this quantum chaos, because it makes it sound like it's something to do with classical chaos, and that's something we don't, that connection isn't clear, so there's a bit of dishonesty there. But furthermore, there's some dishonesty in calling these things probes of chaos, because a precise definition of chaos remains elusive, right? It makes it sound like there's a diagnosis, a consensus on what we're diagnosing. So I'll continue to call these things probes of chaos, with the implication that we're probing many underlying phenomena which we don't quite understand. Okay. So I'll quickly review out-of-time ordered correlation functions. It's actually a pretty old idea. This is dates back to the 1960s, where Larkin and Ovchinnikov wrote down correlation, or they studied electron impurity scattering in dirty superconductors and found that an augmented contour prescription, which we now understand as this object, captured something about the chaotic nature of the scattering, which the normal Green's function did not. And they related this to exponentially diverging trajectories of electrons in the superconductor. But in the modern parlance, we just think about this as a four-point function of a pair of local operators, or a pair of operators in thermal states. Okay. And there's a lot encoded in this object, but at least some rough intuition for what this is capturing. Remember I said that chaos is something like small perturbations growing to affect the system? So one thing that the OTOC captures is operator growth. So if we just take a local spin system and you consider a local Pauli operator at one site, right, and then consider the time evolution of this operator by a chaotic Hamiltonian, right, we can always Taylor expand this time-evolved operator into a sum of nested commutators. And we can understand the growth of this operator as the contribution from higher and higher order nested commutators. So if I just take a commutator of my operator with the Hamiltonian, I'll get maybe a weight 1 Pauli. But as I look at longer and longer, or bigger and bigger nested commutators, I'll see contributions from longer and longer Pauli strings. So one way to measure this operator growth is by taking a commutator of my time-evolved operator with another operator at a distant site. And at time equals 0, these things are on different sites, so they'll commute. Or in a field theory, these are space-like separated operators, so they'll commute. But as I time evolve, right, the support of that operator is going to grow, and this commutator will become large. An equivalent way of saying this is, I can always expand any operator in a basis of Pauli strings, because they form a basis for my algebra of operators. And the dominant contribution in that expansion in Pauli strings moves to longer and longer weight Paulis. Okay? So one thing we can do is take the commutator squared and expand this out. And these first two terms, which I'm going to call boring, or maybe something like not out of time ordered, are just going to go to their disconnected components. But these latter two terms, which kind of capture the essential physics I'm talking about of operator growth, are out of time ordered correlators. Okay. So if we just actually do some numerics in Mathematica, we see that, this commutator squared grows, and equivalently, the OTOC decays. And it shouldn't matter which operators we choose, and this should be a generic feature of a chaotic Hamiltonian. Okay. So this is one thing that the OTOC captures. Moreover, the salient features of chaotic OTOCs, there are kind of two faces to this, should be an exponentially growing corrections at early time. So, it'll stay at some normalized value for some amount of time. And then there are going to be corrections to this normalized value, which grow exponentially in time. And then the long time statement is that this will decay to something small at late times. So these are the two features we expect for chaotic systems.
So in there, you assume that the system is isolated and evolving unitarily?
That's right. I'm just considering isolated systems with unitary evolution. That's right.
Do you know what happens when it's not isolated?
Well, yeah. I mean, we can look at like some subsystem. Well, you mean in terms of this object?
Yeah.
Well, it depends. It really depends what you're setting up. You mean if I look at like operators within some, maybe they have some support in some subregion, right? And I treat the complement of that subregion as a bath. Yeah. Well, there I'll see like the,
I would assume they all decay exponentially.
Yeah. That's right. But in some sense this is a lot more general, right? I'm just this should be true for, I shouldn't have to specify a sub, I mean, yeah, yeah. I mean, I can specify operators with, support and spatial subsystems, but, I think what you're getting at is something like thermalization, and I think that's a more specific statement than what I'm saying here. But yeah, I can come back to thermalization in ETH at the end. Yeah, good. I haven't really specified, how we're taking this thermal expectation value, whether it's like a trace of some thermal density matrix or it's, not quite a thermal density matrix, or it's actually an expectation value in a high energy pure state. But, right now I'm just talking about generic features. Right? Good. Okay. So in recent years, there's been a revival in quantum chaos spurred by studying this object. So, this kind of started with, you can compute this object in gravitational systems where you compute the OTOC as a scattering process in a shockwave background. So shockwaves were nicely reviewed in Yoni's talk yesterday, if you went to that. Scattering calculation, this exponential growth of corrections at early times that I mentioned, you do this calculation and you find a universal exponent for this exponential growth. And you can also compute the OTOC in holographic conformal field theories, where an out-of-time order, a contour prescription for out-of-time ordering, allows you to extract the same universal exponent from the vacuum Virasoro plot. So, moreover, this exponent of early-time growth of corrections is bounded, and gravity or black holes and holographic CFTs are maximally chaotic in the sense that they saturate this bound. So motivated by this, Alexei Kataev wrote down a model of strongly interacting Majorana fermions, which realized many suggestive features of gravitational systems, like an emergent reparametrization invariance and a zero temperature entropy. Moreover, an explicit calculation of a four-point function in this theory shows that you get the same universal exponent. Okay? So this model has since been used as a testing ground for questions about black hole information loss. And more recently, this impressive list of authors studied a quantity called the spectral form factor in SYK to investigate black hole information loss. So Maldacena pointed out like 15 years ago that one baby version of the information loss paradox is that in bulk effective field theory language, two-point functions appear to exponentially decay forever. But if we know from quantum mechanics that we should expect to see some late time fluctuations, and this object is maybe more simply realizes the same contradiction, right? So, some leading saddle analysis, you'll just see an exponential decay, but really we know from quantum mechanics this is a lot more structured. So they studied this object, and I'll talk about this object more in a second, but they studied this in SYK and compared it to the random matrix prediction and found that the two things were very similar. And, they're not exactly the same. There are things here that depend on the spectrum, but I'll say in a minute what the universal features we expect from this object are. Okay. So as a quantum information view can provide guiding intuition and impart valuable lessons, and as more recently, OTOCs were kind of cast in the information theoretic light where they're related to the mutual information to quantify scrambling and related to the frame potential, which I'll talk about in a bit, to quantify randomness. And as chaos is kind of a ubiquitous feature of strongly interacting systems, and as 80s chaos had something to do with random matrices, and as the late time behavior of SYK had something to do with random matrices, our goal is to, in an information theoretic way, understand the role that random matrix theory plays in describing chaotic dynamics and relate these different symptoms of chaos. So are there any questions about motivation or setup? Good. Okay. So I'm gonna have to overview some random matrix theory, and then we'll do a bit of physics. And then I'm gonna have to overview the quantum information tools I wanna use, and then we'll do most of the physics. Okay. So random matrix theory was developed in the 1950s by Wigner and Dyson, and famously had early success in nuclear physics, where it reproduced the nearest neighbor spacings of heavy nuclei. So you took some heavy nucleus, like uranium-238, fired some protons and neutrons at it to excite really high energy states. And then you take all these states, look at the nearest neighbor spacings, make a histogram plot, and that matches perfectly with like a random matrix theory prediction. And this is a parameter-free fit, so it should be impressive. Okay. So this early success kind of heralded its pervasion into many seemingly disparate subfields, including large-end quantum field theory, string theory, transport and disordered quantum systems, knot theory, free probability. And there are three kind of classic random matrix ensembles, the GUE, GOE, and GSE. And today I'll focus on the Gaussian unitary ensemble, which is an ensemble of L by L random Hermitian matrices, where the off-diagonal components are Gaussian random variables, complex Gaussian random variables, and the diagonal components are real Gaussian random variables. With mean 0 and variance 1 over L. So we're going to use a slightly different normalization than the random matrix community, which usually uses variance 1. And this is just so that my spectrum, so like the size of my spectrum doesn't scale with L. If you choose variance 1, the spectrum scales with L. And also, I'll apologize for using L, so I'll write this on the board. But if we think about the Hermitian matrix as my Hamiltonian, here L is like the dimension of my Hilbert space. So it's an L by L matrix. So the quantum information community uses D, and the random matrix theory community uses N, so you can just take L to be a weighted average of the two. Okay. So what's the GUE? So we can break it down by just explaining the different letters. So it's Gaussian in that it has a Gaussian probability weight. It's unitary, meaning that it has a unitarily invariant measure. So the U, O, and S in GUE, GOE, and GSE refer to the invariance of the measure. So this just means for the GUE, I can conjugate by some random unitary matrix, and the measure's the same. And the other way of saying this is we can always average over the over the GUE in the eigenvalue basis, because I can always just rotate to the diagonal basis. Okay, so I can always just diagonalize with some random unitary matrix. So in the eigenvalue basis, the joint probability distribution of eigenvalues is given by this thing here with a Gaussian weight and the Vandermonde determinant. And taking a hint from field theorists, I'm just going to throw all the constants and determinant and weights into some capital D. And so when I average over the GUE, this is what I mean. We average over eigenvalues in this way. Okay. The density of states. So remember, for a single instance of the ensemble, the density of states is just going to be a delta function comb. But when we average over the ensemble, right, this is going to give us some continuous function. So we can compute the density of states by integrating over all but one argument of the probability distribution of eigenvalues. Or more generally, we can compute endpoint correlation functions, so spectral endpoint functions. So you know how correlated are some eigenvalue wiggling here with some other one wiggling over here. By integrating over L minus N, eigenvalues. Okay, and I'll just quote some results. So in the large L limit, the density of states is famously given by Wigner's semicircle law. And the spectral endpoint function can be computed as a determinant of sine kernels. And this isn't super important. Well, it's important that I mention this, but yeah, I just need to make it clear that we know how to compute these things. Okay. So now I'm going to talk about this spectral form factor. So the spectral form factor can be written as the square of the analytically continued partition function. So here, z of beta t is trace e to the minus I h t minus beta h. Okay. And then this thing is just the average of the square of that. This is the same thing as the Fourier transform of the spectral two-point function. And it can also just be written as this double sum of eigenvalues. Okay. So I'll just mention some universal aspects of this, as in if I compute this object for a generic strongly interacting system, what do I expect to find? So this is a function of time, R2. Okay. So at early times, it's at some value, which is z of beta squared. Then I'm going to see some exponential decay. I'll just draw the things first. So there's some exponential decay. And that quickly changes into a power law decay. And the exact power will depend on the system. So for the GUE or SYK, this is a 1 over T cubed. There's some dip. So I'm going to call this time scale here a dip time. There's a linear ramp. Goes as t, and then there's a plateau at a value of z of 2 beta. Okay. And this plateau time here, it's going to be roughly L, which is roughly like e to the s. Okay. Good. So the universal things here, like we should expect these features. The exact initial and late time value will depend on the spectrum. The dip time will also depend on the spectrum, or depends on the system. But the universal things here are like a linear ramp and this plateau. Okay. And I should mention that usually when we do like quantum field theory, or if we're doing some leading, like some perturbative leading saddle analysis, usually we only have control up like up to like this time scale. So everything past here is a non-perturbative effect. So maybe if you have a lot of power over your system, and maybe there like is something like one loop exactness, or you have control over the perturbative corrections, maybe you have control up to like some slightly later time scale. But all of this physics is non-perturbative physics. Okay. Right. So and when we do random matrix theory, we have perturbative control over this entire thing, and it's perturbative in 1 over L. Which is a non-perturbative effect for like a spin system or a field theory N. Okay. And I'll also just mention that there are non-perturbative effects in random matrix theory which contribute around here. And those effects are like doubly non-perturbative for field theorists. Okay. So are there any questions about this object? Okay. Okay. So we can compute this thing for the GUE, and I'll just flash the results because I'll need them later to do physics. So at infinite temperature, we can compute this thing exactly up to non-perturbative effects. So this early time behavior is controlled by a Bessel function, and this late time ramp is given by this R2 term. And if we just plot this, we see something like this, where these oscillations are just from the Bessel function. Okay. We can also compute this thing at finite temperature. So we can do the finite temperature form factor. And we have to use a slightly different regularization procedure to compute this. But again, we find the same thing. See this like ramp and plateau behavior, right? And we have an analytic expression for this function. And we can also compute higher point form factors. So these are Fourier transform of the spectral four-point function. This is also computed as like a z to the partition function, to the fourth. So right, so we can compute these things. Great. Okay. There was a bit of physics, but now I need to go back to reviewing kind of the other like set of tools I'll need. So I'm just going to overview some quantum information machinery. So remember that the Haar measure is the unique left and right invariant measure on the unitary group. Right? So we have a quantum mechanics system. The set of all things I can do to my quantum mechanics system is the unitary group UL. So if we consider an operator acting on the K copies of the Hilbert space, K-fold channel of that operator with respect to the Haar ensemble is just denoted by this, a K-fold conjugation integrated over the ensemble. And equivalently, we can consider some subset of the unitaries, some ensemble of unitaries, and define the K-fold channel over that ensemble as instead integrating the conjugation over that ensemble. So we say that an ensemble is a unitary K-design if and only if the channels are equal. So yeah, this is the formal way to introduce it, but maybe I'll also just re-explain what K-design is for people that don't necessarily think about these things every day. So right, we have the full unitary group. What we're doing is just asking, consider like some subset, a bunch of points on that space, or a bunch of unitaries. How randomly distributed are they? Right? How uniformly distributed over the full unitary group are they? Meaning that if I average over that subset and average over the entire Haar ensemble, how close are the averages, or are they the same? A K-design is a precise a precise measure of how randomly distributed some set of unitaries are. So I'll also just the kind of intuitive thing that helped me. Maybe I'll just do this up here. Understand this, again, if you're not a quantum information theorist. So if there's a notion in math called a spherical design. Okay, and if you just consider polynomials in R3, so a polynomial rank k, okay, and then consider a two-sphere, what set of points reproduce averages over the two-sphere? Can everyone see this, or did I write this in a bad place? Okay, well.
You can write bigger.
Yeah. Maybe I'll go over here, because I think this is good intuition. Right. So we're talking about polynomials in R3, okay, of rank k. So a spherical design is if I average the polynomial over points on the sphere, they reproduce the average over the entire sphere exactly. So a spherical one design is going to be some set of points where the center of mass of those points is the center of the sphere. A spherical two design is like a tetrahedron. A spherical three design is like a cube, right? So as I'm choosing points that reproduce higher and higher moments, so higher and higher rank polynomials when averaged over the sphere. So this is the same idea, right? I'm just, instead of a sphere, I have the full unitary group. So what subset of unitaries reproduce the first k moments of the unitary group.
Nick?
Yes?
In your second expression, this integral is actually a sum over?
So you can choose a continuous ensemble or a discrete ensemble. You mean this? Yeah, yeah. Either is fine. But as long as you can put a measure on.
You introduce this ensemble with an index I.
You mean here?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay,
so
okay.
With respect to this index, just add all these guys and...
Yeah, yeah, so it's an ensemble. That just means I have a set of things and a measure on them, right? Like a probability.
Yeah.
Yeah, 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 that's right, that's right. Yeah, yeah. Sorry. I guess this is kind of a discrete notation. This is continuous, but yeah. You can do either. Yeah, good. Okay. But so for the non-quantum information theorists, is the notion of a K-design clear? Is important. Okay. Good. So yeah, it's not practical to measure this for every operator in my algebra. So a good measure of K-designness is the frame potential. So this is a precise definition of a distance to randomness, in that the frame potential for some arbitrary ensemble is lower bounded by its Haar value. So the frame potential for the Haar ensemble is just k factorial. And how close, you know, you can just compute this thing for a given ensemble, and it's lower bounded by its Haar value. So how close it is to the Haar value is a precise distance to randomness. Okay, so you can compute this thing, it's a number, and you can compute it for any ensemble. And you know, how for a given k, how close it is to k factorial tells me how close I am to reproducing the first k moments of the Haar ensemble.
But is that a statement where you would say the moments are going to be approximated up to something that depends on this difference?
All I'm saying is that if, you're right, so this is equal if and only if the ensemble is a k design, meaning I reproduce the first k moments exactly. And then how close it is a, like a, yeah, it's a two norm distance between these two objects. Yeah. It's really the like distance between these k-fold channels. Good. So it's a, yeah, in this sense, it's a distance to randomness. Okay. And the only other quantum information tool I need is how to integrate over the ensemble. So I'm not going to review this. I'm just going to say we know how to do this. You can integrate over Haar random unitaries. It's a beautiful formulation for doing this, and it's called Weingarten calculus in the spirit of Wick calculus. This makes, you know, this is really some deep connection between unitary groups and symmetric groups, but yeah, we know how to do this. Okay, so why frame potentials? Well, in black hole physics, it often suffices to approximate, you know, some Haar random process by K-design behavior. So, you know, in Hayden and Preskill, they showed that if my black hole dynamics forms a, like a two, or, you know, approximately a two design, then you know, if some powerful observer outside a black hole can reconstruct a state from a you know an m qubit state from a you know from an, like a couple you know, like a m plus a few qubits of Hawking quanta with high fidelity, if the dynamics are approximately a two design. More recently, frame potentials appeared in this OTOC literature where Dan Roberts and Benny Yoshida quantified the chaotic decay of OTOCs by relating the average of all OTOCs to the frame potential. So this small late time value I mentioned, right? So the OTOCs decay and become small. This means that the frame potential becomes something small. So in this sense, it makes precise the distance to randomness, right? So the OTOCs become small, the frame potential becomes smaller and approaches its Haar random value. So what I want to consider now is the ensemble of unitary time evolutions at a fixed time t generated by GUE Hamiltonians, right? So this is a one parameter family of ensembles generated by unitary time evolution, or you know, unitary time evolutions generated by random matrix Hamiltonians. Okay. So we can compute this. You can compute the first frame potential. You just insert Haar random unitaries to rotate to the diagonal basis. Integrate using the second moment, and we can relate the first frame potential to the spectral, these two-point form factors I mentioned before. Okay, and I showed before that we had analytic expressions for these things. So we can just plot this thing. So at early times, so remember this is the first frame potential, so the Haar random value is one. So at early times, we have something huge. We time evolve by GUE Hamiltonians, and then we decay and form a one design, right, at this dip time for a while. And then at late times, we deviate away from this, and GUE is no longer Haar. It's no longer a one design. Okay. So this late time behavior isn't necessarily too surprising. So the intuition for this is if I have, so if I exponentiate some, like, you know, GUE eigenvalues, they have logarithmic propulsion, there's a lot of structure. I exponentiate them, and I can just think about them as phases on the circle. And then I evolve time, so take time to be really large. I'm just running these eigenvalues, you know, these phases around the circle, and at late times, they're going to dephase. So you can do a push-forward measure calculation and show that, at late times, the distribution is IID, right? And this is not HAR, right? HAR eigenvalues, there's structure, there's logarithmic propulsion. So it's not surprising that the late time behavior is different. What is surprising is that, you know, there's some intermediate time reform decay design, right? These GUE eigenvalues become very random and then just dephase. Okay, yeah. And you might say that, so here this late time value is 2. Yeah, sorry.
You have a little bleep around between 1,000 and 10,000.
What,
that one.
Yeah. So this is the, it's 1, and then it's becoming bigger, as I was describing. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. That one is surprising.
Yeah. So this is what the fact that the late time value being different from 1 isn't surprising, because as I said, like, if I think about these as phases, at very late times, all these phases kind of rotate around, these GUE like eigenvalues rotate around the circle, and they dephase. So at very late times, GUE eigenvalues are not HAR. But what is surprising is there's some intermediate time where they are. You might say, all right, well, the late time thing is 2. That's not that different. So here, this late time plateau is at a value of 2. It's not that different from 1. But what you can do is, you know, you spend a few days teaching Mathematica how to do Weingarten calculus, and you can compute the second frame potential. Then you spend another few days optimizing your code, and you can compute the third frame potential. Great, you know, you can stare at these all you want. You're not going to find the meaning of life. But we have, as I said before, right, we can compute these spectral form factors exactly. So we have expressions for them, for the GUE. So yeah, we can just kind of summarize what's going on. You know, there's some early time decay, which goes as these form factors. But for all k, or at this dip time, the frame potential is exactly equal. You know, so remember, this is the HAR random value is k factorial. So GUE, right, at the dip time forms a k-design. But at late times deviates away from this. So these late time values, you know, aren't close to k-factorial. They grow superfactorially. And I have a closed form expression for these late time values, but it's not super insightful. The important thing is it's just very different from the dip value. Okay. It's kind of beautiful, right? Like these GUE eigenvalues, like, you know, you can think about them going around the circle. At some intermediate time scale, they just, you know, they distribute such that they're as random as possible, and they reproduce all these moments of HAR, and then they just dephase. It's kind of cool. Okay. So what have we done? Well, we've related some symptoms of chaos. We've kind of showed, you know, we can relate these form factors to the frame potentials. And we saw that at some intermediate time, we form a k-design, but at late times, we deviate away from this. But what we really need to get at is, you know, why GUE is capturing anything about chaotic systems. Okay. And for this, we'll go to the out-of-time ordered we'll compute some out-of-time ordered correlation functions. But yeah, I should stop. Are there any questions about what we just did? Okay. And we'll take a step back from random matrix averages for a second and just consider some, like, a generic Hamiltonian. I guess I've specified that it's a n qubit system, but what we can do is we can take the average of all two-point functions. So if I just average over all operators A, right? It turns out the average of two-point functions is related to the two-point form factor for any Hamiltonian, right? So this is saying we're not only averaging over, like, local operators, we're averaging over all operators. Okay. And the average of all operators is just, you know, is related to this two-point form factor. Okay. More generally, we can average, you know, the 2k, or like higher point OTOCs over operators and relate them to the 2kth form factor. So, you know, the usual 4-point OTOC is related to the 4-point form factor. And what this does is it gives us a connection between spectral statistics and physical observables, right? Correlation functions are physical observables. You know, two-point function, you kick a system, watch it respond. Okay. This is, I don't know, I guess this is kind of an aside comment, but this is also a way to understand kind of a universal 1 over 6 decay in the OTOC behavior. So there's this nice paper that related identified some power law decay in OTOCs in SYK by mapping it to Liouville quantum mechanics. One way to understand this universal power is just that the average OTOC, 4-point OTOC is just related to the 4-point form factor. From the exact expression I showed you before, we know that that form factor decays with a power of 1 over 2 to the 6. So it's just another way of seeing why this behavior is universal is just that the OTOCs, you know, in this power law decay have just kind of averaged out. I guess it's a side comment. But yeah, this gives us some kind of practical way, this relation between form factors and two-point functions. It gives us a practical way to measure spectral statistics. So we know that, for example, Pauli operators are a one design. So that means I can, you know, exactly rewrite this average over operators as an average over Paulis. And what we can do is just maybe do some numerics and check this in a spin system. So here I'm just going to consider some non-local spin system. These are just basically the sum of all possible two-body interactions in a system with random couplings. I'm just, you know, XY, XX, XZ for all possible sites. Okay, so it's some random non-local spin system. So what we can do is just, you know, for 5 spins, there are like 1,024 two-point functions of this type. We can average over all of them, and we see that it exactly reproduces the two-point form factor. Okay. Moreover, like if say I wanted to actually measure the spectral statistics, measure this two-point form factor, if I just compute like some experiment or something, compute a couple high-weight two-point functions, so two-point functions of high-weight operators, and average them, I should get something that's the exactly R2. We can do the same thing for SYK.
Yes. What are the different curves?
Sorry. So this thick blue line here is the two-point form factor, which I was saying is equal to the average of all two-point functions. So the other 1,024 curves on this plot are just all the other two-point functions. This is for 5 spins, so there are 4 to the 5 different Pauli operators. Good. Right. You can do the same thing in SYK for Majorana operators, and you get the same thing, that the average is equal to the average of all the two-point functions is equal to the form factor. So now back to random matrices. So that was operator averages. Remember from before that we were averaging over Hamiltonians. So if I instead average, say, the two-point function over GUE Hamiltonians, I find that it's the same thing, right? So the operator for the GUE, the operator average and the Hamiltonian average are the same. Okay. And what this is saying is that GUE doesn't really care about the locality of the operators, right? So here, in taking the GUE average, I haven't made any specific claim about how big these operators are, but still it's equal to the average. So it's not super surprising, right? GUE is some random matrix, but at least this makes precise why it's only suited to capture some kind of global properties, right? It doesn't really care about how local the operators are. Right, so moreover, we can also compute the average, the GUE average over OTOCs and relate it to the 4-point form factor. And so what have we learned? Well, one, so we know for the GUE what these functions are. What this first expression tells us is that GUE is going to capture something about thermalization and the apparent loss of quantum information, because we know, and it just means that these 2-point functionals will decay on the order of the thermalization timescales, a timescale of order beta. So in that sense, GUE is suited to capture, thermalization, but GUE doesn't capture scrambling, right? So the 4-point functions decay the same timescale or a little bit quicker than the 2-point functions. It's not a good model for scrambling. And moreover, GUE doesn't care about operator growth or the time ordering of operators. So, the black hole way of saying this is if like I have a black hole and it's evolving with a GUE Hamiltonian, Bob would be able to reconstruct Alice's state in an order one time and then send it to Alice to verify very quickly. So, scrambling times order one. So it's bad. But none of this is too surprising, right? It's a random matrix, but at least formalizes why random matrices fail to capture physics at early times, right? So this is all early time chaos, and random matrices are not capturing it. But more interesting is why random matrices do capture chaotic physics at late times. Right? And the thing, again, the intuition should have is that random matrices are a good description of a system which has lost its notion of locality. So this kind of leads into the last thing I wanted to talk about, So we learned that we saw that a good definition of an approach to randomness is like K-design behavior, but we also learned that the GUE evolution, right, doesn't form a K-design at all times. So if I want a quantity to measure the approach to a random matrix description, just having K-design be my baseline for randomness or baseline for chaotic dynamics is not a good description, because even random matrices don't form K-designs at late times. But the key ingredient that we used in deriving a lot of the expressions was a unitary invariance of the measure. So in how we actually related the frame potential and the OTOCs to the form factors, we just used the fact that we could, diagonalize the Hamiltonian with Haar random unitaries and then compute averages, or I guess integrate over moments of the Haar ensemble. So instead, if we consider an ensemble of unitary time evolutions generated by an ensemble of physical Hamiltonians, where physical here could be something like, an ensemble of Hamiltonians, like something like SYK or a spin system with quench disorder, maybe a quantum field theory on a random lattice, right? These are all ensembles of Hamiltonians. And then what we can do is define a different ensemble, which I'm going to call the Haar invariant ensemble. So we take our ensemble and then conjugate by Haar random unitaries. So more precisely, what we're doing is we have some measure over our physical Hamiltonian ensemble. We're making that measure unitarily invariant. We're defining an ensemble where that measure is unitarily invariant. So what we can do is compute the frame potential for our physical Hamiltonian ensemble and then compute the frame potential for our Haar invariant ensemble. And I'm going to say that I'm going to define K invariance as the statement that these two things are equal. Okay, so our physical ensemble reproduces the first K moments of the Haar invariant ensemble. Moreover, the difference between these two, physical Hamiltonian ensemble is lower bounded by this Haar invariant one. And moreover, the distance between them, or the difference between them, is going to define a distance to K invariance. And I claim that this quantity becoming small signifies the onset of a random matrix description. Okay. So I'll make a couple comments. One, this quantity is always zero for a random matrix, right? For a random matrix ensemble, for the GUE, right, the measure is always unitarily invariant, so these objects are always equal. Okay. But moreover, for some physical system, that shouldn't be true. So it's kind of saying this first quantity depends on, the eigenvectors, right? And the actual dynamics of the system. But this second quantity, this Haar invariant one, only depends on the eigenvalues. So in a sense, this is measuring when the dynamics are scrambled enough that, all you have left is the spectrum. Right. Good. So what next? Well, you need to actually show that this thing is useful. So we can do some numerics. And actually compute K invariance for some spin system. So for example, we can take a non-local spin system that I mentioned before, compute the K invariance, right? At time equals zero, it's just all the identities, so these things are the same. But as we start time evolving, we deviate away, right? And get something large. And then for a very chaotic system, at late times, so non-perturbatively long timescales, for example, here, the one invariance becomes small, this difference I was describing before becomes small, and we become approximately one invariant. So here we see that this late time value doesn't really depend on n. On the other hand, if I choose some local integrable spin chain, right, we see that the one invariance becomes huge, and the late time floor is, again, very, very large and grows with n. So again, this is supposed to, in this top example, right, this is saying that, at some late time scale here, the dynamics are well approximated by random matrices. Okay. We can, again, check this for SYK or some random three-local spin system. And I can explain afterwards you come and ask me what like the actual nature of these floor values is. But yeah, again, you know, these things are small at late times, so you know, these systems have scrambled. Okay. So I'll just summarize. So we computed some form factors for random matrices. We related different symptoms or diagnostics of chaos. We understood the timescales at which GUE was Haar random and you know, a subsequent deviation away from this Haar random behavior. We quantified why random matrices fail to capture early time chaos. We also related you know, observables, like endpoint functions, to spectral statistics. But more importantly, we defined a quantity which is supposed to capture this late time behavior, and we're trying to understand this as k invariants. Right? So there's a lot more to be done. In some extensions, so everything I talked about in this talk, I'd kind of assumed when I was saying universal, it was really universal for systems that break all symmetries. So, you know, if you have some chaotic system, but it respects some symmetry, right, the dynamics can become as scrambled as they want, but the symmetry is still going to be there in the dynamics. So another way of saying it is that just the space in which the unitary time evolutions live in is some quotient of the full unitary group. So what we can do is generalize our, you know, our all these techniques to GOE, GSE, and to all extended ensembles in the tenfold symmetry classification. So this is the same classification that appears in the classification of topological phases. And we can quantify randomness and chaos for these different symmetry classes using Weingarten calculus, where we just integrate over the associated compact symmetric space. So this is also a thing you know, we can do. We can also apply these ideas to study chaos in SYK models, for example, by computing these things for Vishard ensembles. But most importantly, what I really want to continue to think about is understanding what K invariance is actually capturing. So I want to study this more in like random spin systems in SYK and make precise at least what, or make precise the connection between this and maybe something I want to call late time chaos. Okay, so I'll just leave up some things to think about, but yeah, I can end here. All right, thanks. Feel free to ask about these. Questions? Ask about these things.
Yeah. So this thing you call the R2, this form factor, can I understand this is an expectation value of some local operator?
No. It's just the spectrum. So it's just you know, I can write it exactly like as a just like a sum over the eigenvalues. Yeah. Or the other way, it's like defined just from the partition function. So it's a spectral quantity. It's also can be understood as the Fourier transform of the spectral two-point function. So you have some density of states, some distribution, some spectral density. You can ask how correlated, you know, like different eigenvalues are, right? That's the spectral two-point function. The Fourier transform of that is just the like this R2, two-point form factor.
One question. So you said if you introduce symmetry, that the ensemble should be some quotient of the unitary.
That's right, that's right.
So in terms of time evolution, I would think that it's a subset of the unitary group because I only allow certain unitaries.
That's right, that's right.
So how do you get the quotient?
Well, so here this, it's a compact symmetric space. It's not a quotient group. So sorry, I didn't say this was a group. Yeah, so say we can pick an example. Say I have my Hamiltonian as time reversal symmetric. This means that I can always diagonalize that Hamiltonian with orthogonal eigenvectors. The other way of saying that is just that the unitary time evolution lives in UL mod OL. And you're right, that it's not a quotient group, but it's a compact symmetric space. So these compact symmetric spaces are the things that Cartan classified like 100 years ago. So it's the they're not quotient groups. You know, it's like UL mod OL does not form
H
a group.
H is a subgroup, but the overall is not
a
group.
That's right. Because H isn't normal. That's right. Because you know, orthogonal matrices don't commute with all the unitary matrices, right?
But so those are actual group elements that are.
So there's something called a Cartan embedding where I can embed that compact symmetric space into the unitary group. And it turns out in some beautiful papers by Benoit Collins and Sho Matsumoto that you can also, you know, we know how to do Haar integrals over the full unitary group. You can also put the measure on this compact symmetric space, and you can also do Haar integrals over the space. And it's really quite nice. Yeah, good. But, you know, in principle, you know, there are 10 such symmetry classes, at least for free fermions. But, you know, like, I don't really care about classifying all possible systems, just that if my Hamiltonian realizes, like, these anti-unitary symmetries in different ways, one way of understanding that is just that the unitary time evolution operators live in different quotients of the unitary group. So, you know, so for everything I introduced here, like, I should really update all of my, you know, like, k-design, like, measure and k-invariance measure. Instead of comparing, you know, to the full unitary group, I should really compare to a quotient. Because, you know, the dynamics can become as scrambled as they want, but my unitary time evolution operator can never explore outside this quotient space, right? Yeah.
Good. More questions? No? No, then thanks to Nick once more.
Thank you.